Continuing our study of Pachad Yitzchak for Purim with Inyan Yud Aleph, and we hope to accomplish a few Inyanim, they're short ones. Purim Yom Kippurim. Chazal in the Kabbalah compare Purim to Yom HaKippurim. And yet there is one fundamental point of departure with one commonality. Both on Purim and Yom HaKippurim, we speak about a Kabbalah, some sort of resolution. On Yom Kippur, we're talking about Kabbalah Allah Haba, a resolution for the future, to do better. That's the process of tshuva, which is essential on Yom HaKippurim. On Purim, we speak about Kimu V'Kiblu, a pasuk in Esther Perek Tes, and there too there's a Kabbalah. However, there's one fundamental difference, one contrast between the Kabbalah of Yom Kippur and the Kabbalah of Purim. The Kabbalah of Yom Kippur requires a charata. We need charata ala avar and Kabbalah ala asid. That's how the Rambam formulates it in the second parak of Hilchas Tshuva. However, with regard to Purim, we don't find any charata. There's no regret of past. It's purely Kabbalah for the future. And the fundamental difference between these two, I think to shed a light on this, is the concept of moda. Purim is called a Yom Bittul Moda in the Gemara in Shabbos on Peches. What is a moda? When a person enters into an agreement by coercion, not out of a choice of his own, he's moser moda. He makes a declaration, in private of course, in front of two edim, in which he claims that what he's doing is not really him. It's not his own decision. It's not the ani, the I, which is the essence of a person, but rather there are external factors and pressures that are forcing him, compelling him to sign this contract or to enter into this business transaction. Bittul Modah is just the opposite. Bittul Modah is where a person says that whatever Modah, whatever disclaimer was ever proclaimed in the past, is null and void. In effect, Bittul Modah reestablishes the validity of the original transaction. And by being mevatel the tainus modah, a person is telling us that what was done out of the ani, out of the I, out of a freedom. It was not a matter of compulsion. On Yom Purim, which is the day of bittul modah, what we're saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that even if we accepted the Torah and Har Sinai out of compulsion, nasa v'nishma, and even if there was an implicit mesiras modah to say that we didn't freely accept the Torah, we were compelled to do so, on Purim, we accept the Torah willingly. Nasa v'nishma, our Kabbalah, is a reflection of our true essential selves, of the ani of the person. The Kabbalah of Purim, of Kimu V'Kiblu, is a public declaration that it is me, it is I, who is the person who, from my very will, took the oath at Har Sinai of Nasa V'Nishma. And that's what Chazal say, that Nasa V'Nishma, which is at the end of Parashas Mishpatim, is a reference to Kabbalah Satorah, of Mushpa V'Omed Me'ar Sinai. That Shvuah was taken willingly and is representative and expression of my full self, the I, the true, genuine person. This is not external. That's the Kabbalah of Purim. In contrast, with regard to the Charata of Yom HaKippurim, of Yom Kippur itself, the Rambam establishes in Hilchas Tshuva, Perek Beis Halacha Dalid, that the Baal Tshuva makes a declaration, he changes his name and declares, Ani Acher V'Eneni Oso Ha'ish. He's telling us that the person who did these actions, who implemented these averos and violated these criminal actions, is not him. I've changed my name. I've changed my identity. The charat of Yom HaKippurim is a mesiras moda. It's a claim that it was not I who did the sin. The sin is not a reflection of my true, inner, genuine self. I declare henceforth through my charata that those actions were done as a result of external pressures. They do not reflect the ani, my atzmus, my essence. There were all sorts of pressures placed upon me. And therefore, ani acher eineni oso ha'ish. On Purim, on the contrary, by contrast, we have a bittul modah. That's the process. And that's a declaration which emphasizes that that which was done, the agreement that was entered into, the commitment and the oath that was taken at Sinai, were not a result of external pressures. But dafka, the opposite, they emanate from a very deep, profound place in my heart, in my soul, in my essence. And therefore, the roots and the deeper source to the day of Purim and the experience of Purim is not charata. On the contrary, that which we accepted is really ours. Our dedication and loyalty and commitment to Torah is genuine. He says, "Kan hu shorish inyan shamatbea hayom shel Purim ein hacharot meshameshet nosei l'shum dibur." With regards to the formulation expression of Purim, charata doesn't play a role, because on the contrary, the inner meaning and substance of the service of the avoda of itzumo shel yom Purim is to undermine any sort of charata. If there was any modah whatsoever in which I said it's not me, those modos are null and void. The essence of Purim is bittul modah, to contradict and rescind any modah. It's hadar kiblu of bimei Achashverosh. They came back at the time of Achashverosh, and they, the Jewish people, re-accepted and reconfirmed their commitment to the Torah. They said, Kimu v'kimlu, that which accepted is valid because it's truly a reference, a reflection of our inner essential selves. That's the bittul modah of Purim. It's the opposite of charata. We're undermining charata. On Yom HaKippurim, we speak about charata by saying that whatever criminal acts I was guilty of, they're not me. They don't represent me. They were pressured. How does the Gemara say in Masechta Brachos on Daf Yud Zayin that why did I sin? Even though my genuine ratzon is lasos ritzonecha, to fulfill the will of God, it was the Sar Shabbi Isa, it was the Shibud Golios, it was the powers and the compulsion of the Yetzahara Mibifnim, or the Shibud Malchi, is the pressures and the barriers that are placed upon us Mibachutz, externally, by the nations and the society we live in. That's a Mesiras Modah, that's Charata on any actions that were criminal in nature that I was guilty of in the past. That's the essence of Itzumo Shel Yom, the Avoda of Yom HaKippurim. On Yom Purim, on the contrary, it's only Kippur, because it is a Kabbalah, but it's a different type of Kabbalah. It's a Kabbalah which negates and nullifies any Charata, any Modah, and confirms and affirms our genuine, sincere love and commitment to Hashem and to His mitzvos. Moving on to Inyan Yud Beis, which is the subject of which is Mishloach Manos, which is very unique. We don't find it in any day, in any celebration. The Yontif of Purim is the only Yontif which, in order to celebrate the Yeshua, the God-sent redemption and salvation of Jewish people, we do it by sending gifts, Manos, to our friends, to our Reim. What we would try to do in this particular presentation is to give a little bit of a taste, of one of many tastes, but one taste that our heart could taste this mitzvah, the kiyum of this mitzvah. What is the matbea? What is the essence of this avodah of the day of Purim in terms of Mishloach Manos? What does Mishloach Manos represent? And our presentation will begin by reviewing something that we said back in Inyan Beis, based on a pasuk in Bereishis Yudalid, which Chazal interpreted to be a reference to the Shivud Malchios. The pasuk says, Tid'al Melech Goyim. In enumerating the various kings, there was a king by the name of Tid'al. And although all the other kings mentioned and enumerated are related, are kings of a particular nation, this one is Melech Goyim in a general sense. And the Chiddush here is that Tid'al was not the king over a particular city or district or state. He wasn't connected to one particular nationality, but rather to Goyim Bechlal Tid'al Melech Goyim. He represents the connection to all the Goyim. And Chazal understood that this parsha here in Bereishis Yudalid is a reference, is an allusion to the Arba Malchios, the four kingships, which will control the Jewish people and subjugate them throughout the long, bitter years of Golus. Tid'al Melech Goyim, say Chazal, and this is the Bereishis Rabbah, is a hint to Malchus Romi, the fourth of the four kingships that will subjugate the Jewish people. And this fourth Malchus, called Romi, in its opposition to the Jew, is unique. It's not like the other Malchios. With regard to the other Malchios, every kingship unto itself had its own gripe, its own hatred against the Jew, and tried to subjugate the Jew. With regard to Romi, its objection to the Jew was not a limited representation of itself, of Romi itself, but rather it was an attempt to gather together all the Goyim and join all the nations together to rise up against Israel and subjugate her. The Golus that we're in today is called the Golus of Edom, which is an extension of Golus Romi. We are in the throes, the clutches of the fourth of the four kingships. And the name of the Golus sometimes is Romi, sometimes it's called Edom. Because basically from Romi, the anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jews spreads out. The source, the hub, is Romi. But from Romi, there are many tributaries and extensions to pass on and transmit this hatred of the Jew to all the nations of the world. With Romi comes the revelation of Edom as the Melech Goyim, B'Lashon Rabbim, of many nations. And as we discussed earlier in the second Maimar, the unique role of Paras and its subjugation of the Jew is that with Golus Paras, for the first time in Jewish history, we find that Edom connects with other nations of the world. Haman, who represents the nation of Amalek, the nation of Edom, gets together with another nation. He sends out his toxic anti-Semitic program and platform. The propaganda is extended to the king of Persia, namely to Achashverosh. Haman sholech trunya against Klal Yisrael to Achashverosh. We start with Romi, we start with Edom, but we extend to all the Goyim. That is the nature of the Tzara of the Golus of Paras. With Paras, we have a Tzara for the first time in Jewish history of Tid'al Melech Goyim, of that fourth Malchus of Edom, which represents gather together all the nations, send out the propaganda against the Jews, spread it, and like wildfire, it's contagious, and all the nations of the world rise up against Israel. And I'd like to share with you the insights of the Medrash Rabbah with regard to Ziknei Yisrael. The Medrash Rabbah, which the Ramban makes a big deal about in his Perush al HaChumash, says that when the Ziknei Yisrael, the leaders of Israel, needed to travel to Romi to try and represent the Jewish people and achieve the goal of getting Romi to have compassion and operate for the good of Israel, when these leaders had to represent us, what they would do, says the Medrash Rabbah, is first, before they went out, in order to prepare for that trip, they would open up Parshas Vayishlach, the parsha of the confrontation between Yaakov and Esau. Parshas Vayishlach, under the law of Maisa of Asim Lebanim, teaches us how to deal with Edom. We learn the parsha carefully. And one of the perhaps most high-profile, emphasized dimensions of the parsha and how Yaakov relates to Esav is Mincha Hishlucha Ladoni. Mincha Esav Hishlucha in Breishis Lamed Beis in Parshas Vayishlach. And we know what this means. There are many ways in which Yaakov could attempt to win over Esav and to protect the Jewish people. And one of them is by sending gifts. And that's the mincha that the pasuk describes as mincha li'esav hishlucha bedoron in Rashi's language in the name of Chazal. And what's happening here is that when the nations are rising against us, we have to learn from Yaakov Avinu that one of the methods that we have to defend ourselves and to stave off destruction is by sending gifts. Now, of course, if you talk about sending gifts in general, not in the context of Yaakov to Esav, then we're talking about a gift which is an act of love and friendship. And the Gemara says in Shabbos on Daf Yudam and Beis that no sein matonel chaver tzorch lodio kidei laharbos ava. If I send you a gift, I have to notify you that I sent you this gift. Rashi says that as a result, it will be ribui ava. Because you, the recipient, understand, you know that it's coming from me, the giver. And that act of giving is a sincere act of cementing and intensifying a love relationship, a friendship that becomes very profound. And how beautiful it is when you think of a gift that's meaningful for the recipient. And the recipient is absolutely thrilled that you thought of him, and that you thought that he would want this particular gift. It's all a gather of Ava Vareis. But now, imagine the case of someone, for example, who constantly sends a gift to someone out of a sense of compulsion. He has no choice. He's sending it to his enemy in order to give him Chanifa, in order to somehow flatter him and win him over when it's not sincere at all. And if a person does this constantly, we can compare him to what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin Peites, a badoi, a liar, that even if on occasion he tells you the truth, nobody listens to him. And here too, a person who's compelled to constantly be accustomed to give out gifts, which are really just lies, they don't represent any sincere love for the person, it's just chanifa. It's in order to butter him up and pacify him because he's your enemy. Even if he goes ahead and he sends a gift out of a moment of true, genuine love and friendship, nobody's going to pay any attention to it because this person who sends the gift has a chazaka that he's not sending gifts as a reflection or revelation of his love deep down in his heart. He's not sincere. So therefore, when we take the case of Yaakov and Esav, and Yaakov is sending gifts to Esav, in this very mahalach of sending gifts, Yaakov is really, in a sense, polluting the concept of sending a gift, which in its pure form is an expression of Ava, but Yaakov has no choice, and we're going to learn to imitate Yaakov, to send matonos to a person, even though he has no shemitz of love for that person. But let's swing back to Purim. Purim is the day in which Amalek is destroyed. Purim represents the Avdon, the loss, the destruction of the Koach of Enom. On Purim Day, the one day in the year when we don't have to travel to Romy to ask for compassion, because Yisrael is up and Romy is down. This is the one day in the year that we don't learn Parshas Vayishlach. We don't recognize the Mincha Le'esav, that false Hanifa in which we try to flatter our enemies by sending them gifts. Here, on Purim, there's no Nesino V'maton of Hanifa. All our Nesinos convert back to what they originally were in their pure form, expressions of true, genuine friendship, Yedidus of Ava. This Nesina is a Nesina gift which is pure. It's a Matana of Tahara. And it replaces the Sheker, the deceitful and false Mincha of that we give to Esav, to Edom. In its place is the Emes of a Mincha Yaakov. That's what Mishloach Manos Ishrayehu on this day of Purim, the day which represents the downfall of Edom. There's no longer a Mincha Yesav, a Mincha of Hanifa. Instead, we celebrate the day as a day of Mincha Yaakov, giving a gift to Yaakov, to our friends, our beloved Yedidim, to express our Ava and solidify our Reus, our close friendship. It's a Zelu Maseh. Purim is clearly a day of Avodah, of Matanos, of Mishloach Manos, of establishing Ava, of again reinstating Matana L'chaver the way it was meant to be in its genuine pure form, a mice of Ava and Reus. Let's move on to Inyan Yud Gimel. The Pasuk tells us in Esther, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Al Tidame B'Nafshech Li Molet. On a surface level, simple pshat, Haman is warning Esther, don't fool yourself and think that you can hide within the kingship, within the palace of Achashverosh, and you yourself can save yourself, you'll be spared the decree of Haman. And when we hear this and interpret it literally, it sounds like a very, very ugly kind of suspicion that Mordechai is casting on Esther Amalka. And it's very difficult to accept that simple, superficial pshat and assume such a chashad. It's impossible that Mordechai would have suspected Esther of something so low as to try to hide within the palace and protect herself, save herself, without caring for her people. And therefore we suggest reinterpreting this pasuk and the statement, the communication of Mordechai to Esther on a deeper level. The Gemara tells us in Bava Kamma, Daf Tzadi Beis, HaMispal Biad Chaver V'Utzorach Lioso Dover Hu Nene Tchila. If Reuven prays on behalf of Shimon for something that Shimon needs, but Reuven himself needs it, then Reuven, out of the merit of his altruistic prayer on behalf of Shimon, in a sense overlooking his, Reuven's own personal needs, selfish needs, he offers up a tefillah on behalf of Shimon, then Reuven himself loses nothing. Hashem will bestow upon Reuven whatever he petitions, whatever he needs, even though the tefillah of Reuven was on behalf of Shimon. And to explain this Gemara, and why it is that Hashem promises and guarantees that Reuven will be answered, we have to really see the Gemara in Sota, Daf Hei Amud Beis. The Gemara in Sota establishes that there are two fundamentally different kinds of tefillah that are separated by an entire universe. One is a regular tefillah, and the other is a tefillah that comes from a broken heart. Chachamim teach us that there's a special power, a supreme surplus power to the tefillah of a lev nishbar, a tefillah which in its very essence, below the surface, comes from a broken heart. That level of sincerity, of reliance, of total dependence upon Hashem gives the tefillah, the prayer therein, a special power. Now here we have a case where Reuven needs something. His lev is nishbar. He's tzibrachen, as we say in Yiddish. And why is that? Because he needs a Yeshua badly. But nevertheless, although he has within his possession, so to speak, a tremendous power, he owns the power, the merit, and the effect, and the efficacy of the koach of tefillah on the highest level, a lofty tefillah, to ask for salvation when he needs it desperately out of a broken heart. And yet, Reuven takes this power, which Hashem gave him, of tefillah out of a lev nishbar, and what does he do with it? He takes that special dagger of tefillah, that koach tefillah of a lev nishbar, and he uses it l'tovas chavero, for the benefit of his friend Shimon. He's taking his own private possession and magnanimously offering it as a gift, as a contribution to his friend. He needs that very same thing, but he takes the prayer and, so to speak, gives it, transmits it over to Shimon, his friend. He's a nadvan. He's really a magnanimous giver to give his friend a koach hatfil that he has, that is really inherent in the suffering that he's going through and the need that he has for that same Yeshua. Should such a person, who's so selfless, who is so devoted and has such devotion to his friend and is willing to give up on his own koach hatfila for the sake and the benefit of his friend, would it be just for him in the higher sphere, in the heavens, to forfeit his great schus that Hashem gave him as a Baal Yisurim in his suffering with his broken heart? Should he lose? Should he forfeit it? Should that power of tefillah be ripped away from him as a result of his magnanimous care and compassion, his nedivus lev, in order to work on for the benefit of his friend? So the Gemara establishes above a kama, no, hu nena tchila. His magnanimous prayers are fantastic, but they don't rip him or remove him from his koach hatfila. He remains with that koach hatfila. It reminds me, in parentheses, of the Rishonim who interpret that Shimon gives of his Torah to Azariah, who supports him, or Yisachar shares his Torah and his rewards therein to his brother Zvulun, who supports him. But at the same time, that's the schar Torah, which is given over to Zvulun, comes from Shomayim. It's a divine gift. It doesn't in any way detract from Yisachar's schar Torah. And if Shimon in his relationship with his brother Azariah is able to be mezaka Azariah in the schar Talmud Torah, Shimon loses nothing. Here too, if Reuven gives his tefillah over to Shimon for the very same thing that he, Reuven, needs it, and he's a tzibrachan yid, he needs it desperately suffering, then Reuven Hashem will not be robbed of his koach hatefillah hu nena tefillah. And this reveals the deeper meaning of what Mordechai said to Esther, al tidami b'nafsheich lihimolet. Meaning, your tefillah, your prayers on behalf of Knesset Yisrael should arise from a broken heart, from a realization that you, Esther, need the same thing that Klal Yisrael needs, that you need a Yeshua no less than they do. If you will appreciate that fact, then the intention of the power of your tefillah, which will be L'tovas Yisrael, will benefit not only Klal Yisrael, but you yourself as well. Don't forfeit that special mila, that special unique advantage of a mispalel b'yad chaveru v'utzarech li'oso davar. Understand that you need the Yeshua no less than anyone else. You don't have any guarantee of protection here within the palace of the capital of Achashverosh. No. You're exposed and vulnerable to the same dangers as we all are as part of Knesset Yisrael. You're in the same boat. And if somebody drills a hole in the boat, everyone suffers. You too are in that boat. And in order to guarantee that the boat doesn't sink, in order to pray an intense and sincere prayer on behalf of Klal Yisrael for Yeshua, you, Esther, have to understand and feel that you are in need of Yeshua. You're desperate no less than anyone else. And then your heart is a tzebrachana heart. It's a lev nishbar, and you need the same thing that we need. And now we're asking you to offer, on behalf of Klal Yisrael, your best friend, that skula, that special skula power of tefillah v'lev nishbar. And such a tefillah will go up on high and protect Klal Yisrael. Al tidami b'nafsheich limalit. We're moving on now to Inyun Yudalit. The pasuk says in the ninth perek of Esther, L'kayim es yimei ha-purim ha-ele bizmanehem v'kasher kimu al nafsham v'al zaram divrei ha-tsomos v'zakosam. The simple pshat of this declaration is that Klal Yisrael should accept upon themselves the days of Purim to be accepted as holidays with all their particular mitzvahs in the same way that Klal Yisrael accepted the fast days as days of Zaaka. And we have a basic controversy as to how to interpret this pasuk. The Rambam in the fifth parak of Hilchos Tainius Halacha Hey says that the phrase Divrei Atzomos V'Zakosam is a reference to Titus Esther. Let us accept upon ourselves, says Esther, the holiday of Purim with all its mitzvahs in its proper time, just as we accepted the Tainios of 3 days of fasting when Esther gathered together her entire entourage to fast before she went into Achashverosh. However, the Ran in the second parak of Tainis, quoting the Raivid, disagrees with the Rambam and presents the following thesis. The phrase Divrei Atzomos V'Zakosam is an allusion, is a reference to the four Tainios, which the Rabbanan instituted on sad days, on catastrophic days of Churban in the Hebrew calendar year. And a question that arises is, according to those who disagree with the Rambam, what is this mashal? What is the implication of accept upon yourself the days of Purim the same way that we have accepted upon ourselves the four Tainios during the course of the Hebrew calendar year? What meaning does it have to compare, by analogy, the four Tainios to the Kiyum of and the acceptance upon ourselves of the day of Purim? At least according to the Rambam, we're talking about Titus Esther. It makes sense that she would turn to the people and say, well, we accepted Titus Esther as a fast, and we successfully brought about, through Hashem's help, the salvation. Now, let's accept upon ourselves the celebration and the joy, expressing gratitude to Hashem for that salvation. But if you go with the opinion of the Ran and the Raivid that we're talking about Divrei Atzomus v'Sarkasam, the four tinyos, what connection is there between the four tinyos and the celebration of Purim? Where's the parallel, in a sense, to the Kiyum and the Kabbalah of Yimei Purim from the Arba Tzomos? And in order to answer this question and reveal the deeper meaning of this pasuk and this analogy to Yimei Atzomos, according to the Ran and the Raivid, what we need is to take a look at a Gemara in Psachim, Daf Nun Amid Beis. And that Gemara bases itself on a pasuk at the beginning of Mishlei Al Titosh Torah Simecha. Let's clarify, let's answer the following question. When there is a Kabbalah at a particular time during a particular generation, what makes that Kabbalah obligatory on generations to come? Why is it that if my grandfather committed himself to a particular religious act, that obligates me? And the answer is that it's not that each generation is separate, and therefore the Kabbalah of one generation, the early generation, is limited in its scope and in its effectiveness to that generation. But rather, as the Gemara says, Al Titosh Torah Imecha, the halacha requires that we have a commitment to those Torah minhagim of our forefathers, of our ancestors, of our foremothers. However, there's another distinction that's made by the Maharal Prague to explain how is it that the Kabbalah of one generation engenders a responsibility and obligation on the next generation. And the Maharal Prague develops the idea in his Gur Aryeh on Rashi within the context of the oath that Yosef imposed on Bnei Yisrael to bring his remains out of Egypt and bury them in Eretz Yisrael. With regard to this oath, this Shvuah, the Pasuk says in Breishis Nun, Pasuk Chaf Hei, Hishbati Yosef es Bnei Yisrael Avi Atzmosav. You'll find it in Shmos Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Tes. And Rashi there in Shmos makes the following strange comment. Rashi says, Sheshbia es Echov Sheashbiu es Bnei, that Yosef imposed the Shvuah on his brothers, the other 11 brothers of the 12 tribes, and the substance of that Shvuah is that they would be Mashbia, they would impose the Shvuah on their children. And the Maharal says, Mimonashach, I don't understand it. If the Shvuah and the commitment of one generation, the earlier generation, engenders a commitment, it has the power and the authority to impose itself on future generations, then why was it necessary for Yosef's brothers to be mashpia their children, if they themselves accepted this commitment to bury Yosef in Eretz Canaan? Then there's no need to be mashbia their children. Their Kabbalah is machayev, it engenders a chiyuv for their children. And if, on the other hand, they don't have the ability to make a Kabbalah on themselves that would obligate the next generations, then why would they be able to be mashbia the next generation? What commitment do their children, the children of the Shvatim, have to fulfill the obligation and the commitment of their fathers of the Shvatim? So therefore, the Bimanefshach, the kasha of the Maharal, is that whichever way you slice it, you're in a difficulty. Either there was no need to be mashpia the bnei ashvatim because the kabbalah and the shvu of the shvatim themselves would be machayev the dar that comes afterwards, or if there is a need to get a commitment from the next dar and the first dar cannot be machayev the second dar, then the shvu of the children of the shvatim, That doesn't seem to be a meaningful shvua. I mean, there's nothing compelling them, and even if they would take a shvua, that shvua would not be passed on to the next generation. And the Maharal answers this question by suggesting that when Yosef was mashbia his brothers, the shvatim, at that point the number was 11 shvatim, and there was no klal Yisrael. If there's no klal Yisrael, then the shvatim could not be mashbia, could not be take a shvua in such a way that would be mechayev their children, because they themselves, the shvatim, are not klal Yisrael, they don't represent klal Yisrael. However, once the shvatim, or mashbia, the next generation, which includes all the shvatim, all 12 shvatim, the shvua is chal on the klal. And that engenders a commitment for all generations to come. All generations are part of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is an entity that spans all generations. It's a metaphysical unit, and it's not limited to one dar. And therefore, the Shvuah, so far as it's taken by the Bnei HaShvatim, does not have to be retaken to the grandchildren, or the great-grandchildren, I should say, because once the grandchildren took the Shvuah, actually, one second. Once the children, I should say, once the children of the Shvatim took the Shvua, they did so as Klal Yisrael, because now even the children of Yosef are included. We have representation of all 12 Shvatim. Now we have Klal Yisrael. That Shvua, once taken, engenders a commitment for all generations. What we learn from this Maral is a fantastic conclusion, a new principle, and that is that the concept of Klal Yisrael is one entity that spans all generations. And just as each individual can accept upon himself as a yachid, a kabbalah, a commitment, so too there's a koach for Klal Yisrael to take upon themselves a commitment, an obligation through a kabbalah, which is chal for all generations, for each yachid and yachid in that generation, and for all future generations, for all time. And this is the difference within the context of the Sugim Psochim between Altitosh Mitoras Imecha and the Kabbalah of Klal Yisrael. With regard to the first aspect of Altitosh Mitoras Imecha, that is something that relates specifically to one lineage, one line. Whereas the second commitment and the second Kabbalah, that of Klal Yisrael, that is not limited to one generation, but applies to all generations. So when we fulfill the obligations that derive from Kabbalah Sadoros of earlier generations, we can do so under one of two categories. We can do so under the category of Altitosh Toras Imecha, or under the category of Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael. And there's a fundamental difference between the two. Mitzad hatochen anafshiu, mitzad hatzurasa deshmaitata, nivdalose shtei avchanot halalu, achas mechaverta, hevdel atzum. With regard to the first Kabbalah, that I am obligated as a result of Altitosh Mitoras Imecha, that obligation is not at all connected to a personal hischaivus. We're only obligated to do so because of our parents. We are only committed to continue the shibud and the self-kabbalah that was accepted in the previous generation, but in the concept, the second concept of Kabbalah is Klal Yisrael. Here we're talking about something of a different flavor, a different color. We're talking about an approach in which we ourselves, the future generations, were part of, in a personal way, that hischaivus, that acceptance, and that commitment. we are no different than the earlier generations, because within this context, there's no difference between one generation and another. All generations bind together, unify together in one entity. And the Kabbalah of one generation is the Kabbalah of all generations. That's the concept, the fantastic and powerful, far-reaching concept of Kabbalah is Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael means not Klal Yisrael at one particular moment, but Klal Yisrael that spans all time and connects all generations. And at this point, the Pachad Yitzchak wants to highlight the period of the Yeshua of Paras. He says the following. Historically, Klal Yisrael experienced what's called Golus Ashur, or in other words, Golus of Asoras HaShvat. There were 10 Shvatim that were lost, that were cut off from Klal Yisrael. And if that be the case, we're left with 2 Shvatim that are left over, and you cannot call those 2 Shvatim Klal Yisrael. And therefore, in the post-Golus Aseres HaShvatim period, meaning following the historical period of the exile of the 10 Shvatim, when we're left with only 2 Shvatim, there's no longer a concept of Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael. They can't be so, because as the Maharal said with regard to the 11 Shvatim at the time the Shavuos Yosef had burying him in Eretz Canaan, 11 Shvatim is not enough to engender an obligation, a commitment, and impose it on all generations, future generations, but Torah's Klal Yisrael, because 11 is not 12. The absence of the 12th Shevet impairs the status of the 11 Shvatim as Klal Yisrael. L'chora, we would say, how much more so should this apply with regard to Golus Ashur of the Aseres HaShvatim, when you're left with only 2 Shvatim out of 12, it's very difficult to say that they would represent Klal Yisrael, their Kabbalah would be Mechayev future generations. But all this is not true. And the Chiddush here is that even in the post-Golus Asar Shvatim period, there is a status, an entity of Klal Yisrael with regard to those who survived, however, who were not exiled in Golus Asher. And the most profound example of this is the 4 Tainios. The 4 Tainios have their source in a period of time which is post Golus Asar Shvatim. But it must mean that the status of Klal Yisrael returned to those who were spared that Golus. Those 2 Shvatim now represent Klal Yisrael. There's a new entity called Klal Yisrael in the post Golus Asher period, which is represented by the sum total of 2 Shvatim out of 12. And it's only a result of this reinstatement, if you will, of the status of Klal Yisrael, in this case the 2 Shvatim, that there is a possibility of establishing for all generations an obligation to commemorate 4 fast days. The Kabbalah of Klal Yisrael with regard to those 4 fast days is only feasible if we postulate that there's a reinstatement of the status of Klal Yisrael in the post-Golus Ashur period after 10 Shvatim were lost. And now let's talk about the Yeshua of Purim. This is the first salvation historically it follows Golus Ashur. If that be the case, we understand why the pasuk brings a mashal from Kabbalah's Dalet Tainius to Kabbalah's Moed HaPurim. The analogy is perfect. To the same extent that Klal Yisrael accepted upon themselves Divrei Hatzomos V'Zakosam, so too they accepted upon themselves the days of Purim. The purpose of this analogy is to undermine a mistake that Kabbalas Yimei HaPurim would only engender an obligation upon future generations because of Al Titosh Mitoras Imecha, just because I'm chayev to do what my parents did and my grandparents did. No, The Chova of Purim is incumbent upon us under the category of Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael. We personally, in every generation, insofar as we're part of the Retzef, the continuation, the chain of Klal Yisrael, we accepted upon ourselves Purim. And the dogma, the paradigm for this is the Arba Tzomos. From there we learn that the status of Klal Yisrael was returned to those Shvatim that were not included in Golus Ashur. And the fundamental difference now between Altito Shtar Simecha or Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael is that with regard to Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael, this is not just passing on a commitment that took place in earlier Doros, but rather what it means is that we ourselves in every generation are part, actively part and parcel of this Kabbalah. And that's why, if we go back to the Pasuk, it says, Kasher Kimu al Nafsham, etc. V'al Zaram. In other words, the Kimu is not just for them, but it's al Zaram, in the same way that in Divrei Tzomos V'Zakosam, the Nafsham v'al Zaram becomes one entity. It's Nafsham hyphenated Zaram, because it's all part of one indivisible entity that spans all generations called Klal Yisrael. The Kabbalah of Purim and its Moed is a Kabbalah of Klal Yisrael. We're not back to the first category of Altito Shtar Simecha, but rather we're in the category of a Kabbalah Simei Purim that belongs to all Doros. Every single generation is equally involved actively in the Kabbalah Simei Purim. There's no difference between the original generation that accepted Purim and all the generations that will fulfill Purim throughout Jewish history. It's Al Nafsham, the Al Zaram. There's a Kabbalah and a commitment, not just for that generation, but for each generation thereafter, insofar as every generation is part of the entity called Klal Yisrael and is included under the Kabbalah of Kabbalah's Klal Yisrael. So we're going to stop now with the completion of Yudalit, and Emir Tzashem B'li Neder, what we want to cover next time is Tesvah. And just by way of introduction, I wanted to mention to you that in Tes Vav, we want to discuss the concept of Shushan Purim. And here in Yerushalayim, of course, that becomes a very important piece because we celebrate Shushan Purim here on the 15th in Yerushalayim. This year it's going to come out on a Friday. So, Mirtz Hashem, God willing, in the next shiur, which will cover Inyan Tesvav and beyond, we will talk about Shushan Purim. That's what hopefully will happen. Thank you very much.